Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network today. Larry Mueller here talking about rabbits and exotic animals on the show. What makes them good companions and how you can properly care for them. To help us out, Dr. Kurt Sladke is our guest today. He's a clinical professor of zoological medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. He's here to help us understand our exotic pets and talk about your pet care questions as well. So, what questions do you have about exotic animals? What do you love about your exotic pet? Give us a call at 800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@wpr.org, and we'd certainly love to hear from you. And Dr. Kurt Sladke, welcome. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Good morning, Larry. How are you?
Well, I'm doing fine. I hope you're doing well.
We are doing well. We're under the circumstances. We're seeing more and more patients at the vet school compared to just a couple months ago. And
things are working out.
So far, so good. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about rabbits just to begin with. Some people might not even consider them to be exotic, I guess. What makes them unique?
Yeah, I think, there's a little bit of a misnomer between, I mean, they're commonly put into the exotic pet category, although they are basically domesticated animals. They are very interactive with people. They're very social. They can be, they respond to their name. They can be taught to do tricks, much like dogs or even cats, although cats, we know, are a little more stubborn. Rabbits are tend to be very friendly. They are social. They like to usually have another companion rabbit as in the household as well. They seem to prefer that as long as they get along. They do make great pets, and they're probably of all the small mammals that the vet school sees at University of Wisconsin, they're probably the number one in terms of sheer patient numbers of the exotic mammals that we see. We see a lot of rabbits.
So what should people know before they get a rabbit? Probably they might want to get two.
A lot of rabbits, some rabbits don't get along. Many organizations like the House Rabbit Society, which is a national, international organization, and there is a House Rabbit Society in Madison, they do have foster rabbits and adopt rabbits out as pets. Pet stores certainly sell pet rabbits. People need to understand that rabbits are social. They do get along with other rabbits, but sometimes they don't. If you adopt one rabbit and then a year later adopt another rabbit, you need to introduce them slowly, because sometimes rabbits can be fairly aggressive to other rabbits. So kind of knowing their boundaries, getting them adjusted to each other is really important. And then I would say, like a lot of exotic pets, it's typically the owner's ability to feed and care for animals properly that may or may not lead to disease problems. One of the things that rabbits that's very important for rabbits is how to provide a proper nutrition, how to feed them properly as they age, because probably one of the biggest health problems we see in rabbits is dental disease from not being raised on coarse hay, for example, as an important part of their diet. If they're not exposed to eating or used to eating coarse hay, they tend to over time develop dental issues, which requires typically anesthesia and some sort of veterinary intervention. So feeding is really important. They can learn to use litter boxes like cats. They take a little more work typically to get them used to litter boxes, but they can be litter trained. They make great pets even in apartments because they are a small mammal. In places like Tokyo, Japan, where people live in the city in smaller apartments. Rabbits are very popular because they're fairly easy to take care of if they're litter trained and allowed to hop around a small space. So generally, while it's great to have a larger space for rabbits, it's also important or it's also possible to have them in smaller apartments as well.
Yeah. The food, can you go to the local pet store and get the food that you need for the rabbit?
Typically, people, rabbit owners, either go to the local pet store and buy some sort of a coarser hay, a Timothy hay or a grass hay, which is a little bit different than alfalfa hay. When rabbits are younger, they can eat alfalfa hay. It's a little higher in calcium, and as they age, we try to pull that calcium. We want them to eat less of that calcium, so we tend to promote providing your rabbit with some sort of a coarse hay, a grass hay, a Timothy hay. It's very important for their teeth, but also has a little bit less calcium. And then we usually recommend that the owners feed small amounts of a Timothy hay-based or a coarse hay-based pellet, which is what you'd typically think of feeding rabbits, right? Little pelleted food that they eat. In fact, it's really important to feed them the coarse hay mostly, and then a little bit of the pelleted hay. And then people typically feed rabbits some leafy green vegetables, maybe a little bit of carrot or a little bit of sweet potato, things like that to provide some sort of environmental enrichment for them.
Yeah, that makes sense. I feed my cats. I don't feed them totally greenies, but I give them greenies for their teeth.
So
the hay probably serves that same purpose as a greenie would for a cat.
If the rabbit is raised on coarse hay, and if they don't have some rabbits do have a genetic sort of predisposition to having bad teeth. That's just part of, all animals, that you might be born to have bad teeth. But for the most part, if you can get your rabbits eating coarse hay for most of their entire adulthood, you have a much less likely incidence or prevalence of dental disease in rabbits. So it has that sort of same effect. Pet stores tend to promote other chewable toys, wood products for rabbits, but really they don't really provide much in the way of preventative tooth problems, because rabbits can only chew with or bite with their front teeth, their incisors, and generally the major tooth problems we see are their premolars and molars, the teeth that are in the back where they do a lot of their heavy chewing.
How long do they typically live, say, with the right care?
Well, probably the oldest rabbits we see at the vet school are 12, 13-ish, maybe even up to 14. I would say a typical rabbit lifespan might be in the 9, 10-year range. And then you get some that buck that trend and live a few years beyond that.
Chris in Black Creek has a question. Let's go there. Chris, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. It's me again, Chris Sander, crystalsforkids.org. And for your guests, yes, they are totally litter box trained. I've had three different times my lady friend, we litter box trained them. If you just keep them from chewing on things in the apartment, you gotta give them something else to chew on. But one of them actually was so aggressive, as you mentioned, Chris, that it nailed the rear end of a cat that she had and had a tuft of hair in its mouth, nailing that cat in the butt. The cat never got near it again. But anyway, so I run a mountain camp in Colorado at 13,000 feet, but down in tree line at about 3 o'clock, we're standing in camp and this little kind of a dwarf gray to more black, evenly colored bunny came down into our camp, dashing around under the firewood, into my screen tent, underneath the ATV, dusting itself off, shaking, came right in front of me 4 feet away. And I was like, what are you doing here? And it just shook it, the dust off it, and then it hobbled off in the woods. Next day, came back, did the same thing. Rat ran all through my camp, dusting around. And finally, I figured it out, Chris. That thing was probably so loaded with fleas, they were driving it nuts. But I'm curious, in that region of Colorado, St. Isabel Forest area, at about 11,000 feet, looked like a wild dwarf black cottontail of some sort. Do you know what kind that is, Chris?
No, it sounds like it could be a hybridized rabbit, like somebody may have let a pet rabbit go at some point, and it may have hybridized with a wild rabbit, or it just adapted to being out in the wild and survived. But in terms of like a wild type rabbit, it would be pretty unusual. The color pattern you're mentioning would be pretty unusual for a true wild type, rather than maybe a hybrid with a pet rabbit at some point that was let loose. That's not uncommon that people will unfortunately release their animals into the wild.
Oh, Chris, thanks for calling. I want to give Carol in De Pere a chance. Hi, Carol.
Yes, good morning. I would like to know if it would be safe to have a rabbit in a household that has a person with a compromised immune system.
I mean, of all of the exotic pets, there are no significant diseases that we worry about that are readily transmitted from rabbit to human. So there are a few, you know, for pet birds, there are some obvious ones for reptiles, but for pet rabbits, we generally don't have any what we'd call zoonotic diseases that are readily transmissible from rabbit to human, especially an immune compromised person. So they would make a good pet. And our last caller, I should mention, we do see rabbits that do tend to chew on carpeting and sometimes even chew on electrical wires. So rabbits are definitely chewers. So you have to do a little bit of rabbit proofing for your house sometimes, depending on the personality of the rabbit.
Okay. Carol, there you go. Sounds like a good option for you. Rosie in Ashland, it's your turn. Hi, Rosie.
Hi. My daughter has had three different black rabbits as pets. Being a chemistry teacher, they were named Cobalt, Ferris, and Carbon.
I don't Very know clever.
Between the first two. Very successfully, many years with each of them. And they are so friendly. I enjoyed visiting with her rabbits. And what we figured out is the whole purpose of a rabbit, because they can be potty trained for the wet part, but the poop is very dry, hard pellets that they have very little control over. So their job on Earth is to eat the vegetable tops and fertilize the rest.
Yeah, sometimes the probably the biggest complaint about the litter box training in rabbits is that they do catch on pretty quickly to urinating in the litter box, but sometimes the fecal pellets drop around the house occasionally.
There you go. Rosie, thanks. That's a great story about the rabbits and the rabbit names. Appreciate it. Well, Dr. Kurt Sladke is our guest today. He's a clinical associate, clinical professor, I should say, of zoological medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Laura Pavin, our producer today, our on-air producer, Jana Rose Schleiss, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you are listening to the Ideas Network. Taking a look at pet care today and talking specifically about exotic animals, everything from rabbits to snakes to rats to, well, you kind of know what I'm talking about here. I hope you'll join in with your own questions or comments as we move along today. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org, and open lines will get you on pretty quickly. Gail emailed us to share that her bunny seems less interested in being brushed than she was last year. Do you have any suggestions, Dr. Sladke, for interaction or play with pet rabbits? I'm just wondering about the brushing issue.
I would say that the more, in terms of interacting and playing with rabbits, the more you sort of encourage that, especially from a young age, the more playful and not only playful, but interactive they will become with you. Rabbits like to box, for example, and when I say that, they like to, some people use pillows and almost have like a mini pillow fight with the rabbits. They like to box at the pillow to play. Brushing, depending on the breed of rabbit, some rabbits have really dense hair coats, and when they go through a shed, they get tufts and tufts of hair that literally are very easy to pull out, and those rabbits really require brushing. Sometimes we've had a few cases of rabbits where we actually need to sedate them in order to brush them out, because they get really matted hair balls, matted hair, and we need to kind of work with brushes and combs. Our technicians need to work with brushes and combs to get it out. I think in terms of getting your rabbit used to brushing, If you've successfully brushed your rabbit in the past, and this year for some reason something has changed, I would probably maybe start out with some softer brush. Go and buy a softer brush and get the rabbit used to every day just a little bit of time, just getting used to the rabbit, getting the rabbit used to having the brush kind of go across the hair just for a few minutes every day, to just get it back in sort of the swing of brushing, until you can build back up to that, so that your old fashioned or your old method of brushing.
That makes a lot of sense to me. Again, you can join us at 800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Lynn in La Crosse has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I acquired two bunnies, Totoro and Lori, and I acquired them at different times. They were found outdoors, so someone had released them. But I had them on a screened porch. It was my front porch. And I would pull them in at night, but I did have the door propped open and a collapsible fence so they could go outside during the day as they pleased. And then I would pull them in at night, they would come in at night. And I lost both of them last Monday. I woke up Monday morning and went out at 5 o'clock in the morning, because they are crepuscular and they like the dawn and the dusk. And I found both of them just laying on their sides. They looked like they were just cashing, but they didn't hop up to me like they usually do. And both of them were paralyzed. Their back legs were paralyzed. And I did put them, took them to the vet and had them put down. But I'm wondering, I went on the internet and I'm wondering, outdoors in their fenced area, could they have been exposed to, like, there were squirrels and the robins and birds and, one time I did find a little baby bunny in there, but they weren't near it. But I'm wondering if I read on the internet that there was some kind of that from urine from other animals that were had a, some kind of parasite or something. Whether they could have been exposed, because for both of them to be paralyzed was just it was just horrific for me. But I'm just wondering. I've had rabbits before. I never let my rabbits out as I have these. But I'm just wondering what might have occurred because it was terrible.
I'm sure it was. Dr. Sladke, what do you think?
Well, you know, there are probably it is unusual to have two rabbits simultaneously paralyzed and have to get to the point of having them euthanized. So there are several things that come to mind. When we typically see a paralyzed rabbit, the first thing, if it's a single rabbit, we think that they've been playing too rough, and sometimes they'll fracture their spine. That's a fairly common cause of paralysis in like a single rabbit. It would be unusual for two rabbits to do it simultaneously. So the other things outside that could potentially cause a problem, the one parasite you're thinking of, I believe, is encephalitozoan cuniculi, which is a little protozoal parasite that's very common. Infects rabbits very commonly, oftentimes rabbit to rabbit, so infected rabbit to non-infected rabbit through feces and urine, mostly urine, and it causes an encephalitis. But usually, it's not an acute event like you're describing. It's not something that when they're infected causes acute paralysis and death. It usually takes a while for that parasite to kind of build up in the brain and cause the encephalitis. Other possibilities of a rabbit that's exposed to outdoors certainly would be any sort of pesticide or herbicide that gets too close. If they're exposed to something in the environment, a neighbor or even on your lawn, some of the pesticides and herbicides could cause sort of an acute event like that, or even West Nile virus. You know, we don't have a lot of evidence that West Nile virus, obviously it's a mosquito-borne disease. Mosquitoes transmit it. We hear a lot about West Nile virus in people, horses, and birds, crows in particular. West Nile virus can infect a lot of animals, many, many different animals. Again, usually if an animal is infected with West Nile virus, it's not like it could cause fairly rapid death, but usually not. It would be odd that two rabbits, it could be that your two rabbits got infected. It would be odd that they would both become paralyzed immediately, but does cause encephalitis. It does cause central nervous system disease. So I don't have a great answer, but those are the things that came to the top of my kind of forefront of my brain as you were describing it.
Yeah, Lynn, thank you so much. I'm sorry for your loss. Let's take another call. Alyssa in Tomahawk, you're next. Hi, Alyssa.
Hi. I have a pet rabbit that I had adopted from another owner. The rabbit is about 4 years old and has, when I got the rabbit, it had a growth. The previous owner said that there was nothing wrong with the growth, nothing to be concerned about. The growth is located underneath my rabbit's chin area. It's about the size of a... And over the year that I've had the rabbit myself, it doesn't seem to have grown. However, I am concerned in the fact that it is, like if you try to kind of pet the rabbit underneath, it does seem to be an area of sensitivity. Just wondering if growths are common in rabbits. Is that something that should be checked out by a vet, or is this something that the rabbit should be fine?
What size was it again? How big was it?
Just a slightly larger than, or about the size of a ping pong ball, I would say. And it doesn't feel hard in trying to touch it. It's not a firm growth. It's rather soft.
Okay, well, a ping pong ball is a pretty good size. Dr. Sladke?
Yeah, could you broke up a little bit. Could you describe where it was again? I think you said under the chin.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And is it closely associated with the jaw, the bone itself?
I'm sorry. Say that again.
Is it closely associated with the bone, the jaw, the bone of the lower jaw?
More connected to the neck than it is the lower jaw of the rabbit, so it doesn't affect her feeding at all.
Okay.
Okay.
So I would recommend a growth the size of a ping pong ball is absolutely not normal, and I would definitely recommend having a veterinarian check it out and maybe even take a biopsy or an aspirate, just put a needle in it and look at the cell types and make sure it's not something that's malignant. One common thing we see in rabbits are abscesses. So they can get abscesses in and around their face. Usually they're associated with either a tooth root problem if you have other rabbits, sometimes it's a bite wound. Rabbits always seem so cuddly and sweet, but sometimes they just don't get along with each other and they will bite. But tooth root abscesses are definitely a problem. This doesn't sound like it's closely associated with a bone, which would be a more typical tooth root abscess, but I would probably have it looked at just to make sure, just for peace of mind.
Yeah, for sure. Good luck, Alyssa. Thank you for calling. Anne, in Stevens Point, it's your turn now. Hi, Anne.
Good morning. I have just successfully incubated a couple of batches of painted turtle eggs. So I've got these tiny little turtles, which I intend to release. But I normally, or often, painted turtles will stay in the nest until the next spring. And I know they're very vulnerable to predation and so on. Any suggestions how I might help these guys out, get them started before I take them out and release them?
Where were the eggs from?
Well, they were from my garden. The females come up and they dig nests and they never make it because the raccoons find them, or I have heavy clay soil, or it gets too wet, or it gets too dry. I have watched nests in the past and they've never had. So I decided this year, all right, I see where she did it. I'm going to dig them up and try to incubate them, and voila, I've got some baby turtles.
Wow.
So I want to release them, of course, and.
Yeah.
It'd be nice to help them out a little bit the first few days or whatever, if you have any suggestions.
When did they hatch?
They're hatching this morning. I just opened. They're only 54 days. Normally they're more like 70. So obviously the temperature I kept in the incubating chamber in the mid-80s moved them along.
Mm-hmm.
There are actually only a few of them have started hatching. I have almost two dozen eggs from three mm-hmm. nests.
All right, so you must live near water.
Absolutely, yep.
Probably the best thing to do, because it's really hard to, for hatchlings, it's really hard to get them to eat something that you could provide. Probably the best thing you could do is get them into the water and kind of get them off on their own, certainly now before the winter comes. I know that some people will keep and overwinter animals, but your challenge would be actually getting them to feed on anything. And right now, my guess is that they would be, this is probably a good time to release them, even though as long as you get them near the water, that decreases the possibility of raccoons getting them right away. But, I think getting them into sort of the natural waterway will get them feeding on their own.
There you go, Anne. So you may be making numerous trips to the lake or the water for them, but that sounds like a good plan. Thank you so much for calling. Alicia in Duluth, Minnesota, it's your turn now. Hi, Alicia.
Good morning, Larry, and the good doctor. I just was hoping that you would discuss the importance of the Timothy hay for the digestion and the bunny gut because of blockages and things that most people who adopt bunnies don't really think about or are unaware of. And some very sad results can come of, you know, improper diet and, you know, too many carrots, sweets, and stuff like that.
Right. Mm-hmm. A good question. So back to the coarse hay, Timothy hay being important. So when we talk about the gastrointestinal tract, we start at the mouth and kind of go all the way back to the rear end. So the coarse hay is very important, I mentioned, for dental, for maintaining healthy teeth. But rabbits have big cecums, so they have they're called hindgut fermenters. So they need coarse hay material in their gastrointestinal tract, not only to make things move and contract appropriately in the gastrointestinal tract, but they have this big vat in the back of their gastrointestinal tract, their cecum, which is equivalent to our appendix. Our appendix is a vestigial cecum, and they do a lot of fermentation in that hindgut, in that cecum, where the hay is very important. And if people are feeding, for example, Alicia mentioned too many carrots, anything with a lot of sugar in, too much sugars, fruits, carrots, can upset the microbes, the microbial, the bacterial balance in that cecum and cause some real problems. The cecum is very complicated because it produces, at night, it helps produce soft feces that rabbits ingest for vitamins. And then it switches over and produces those hard bunny pellets you see all over your yard, or if you're a rabbit owner, all over the litter box or your house. So it's a very complex organ, but coarse hay is really important all the way through the digestive system, from mouth of, in terms of teeth, to the hindgut, the cecum, and then the production of these pellets. And the two most common problems, veterinary problems we see in rabbits, I did mention dental disease, it's one, but the other is what we call gastrointestinal stasis, which means for whatever reason, the rabbit either is stressed out or has chewed too much carpet material or something like that, and they stop, their gastrointestinal tract shuts down, stops moving. Perhaps they have a too much hair from over-grooming in their stomach, and it can cause a true obstruction. So that's another problem we see. Usually that problem is a little more fixable than some of the dental disease we see, but those are the two most common. Again, feeding rabbits is appropriately is ultimately will prevent a lot of problems down the line, of veterinary medical problems down the line.
Yeah, there we go. Alicia, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, let's turn to Lydia in Madison next. Hi, Lydia.
Hi. I have a question regarding rabbits. I'm interested in purchasing a rabbit, a small breed rabbit, not something that gets big like some Holland Lops. So if you could tell me what rabbits remain small, and also, too, how can you tell if a rabbit is healthy when you purchase it, and do they need vaccines, and what's a good type of litter to train them with?
Oh, some great questions. So your options for rabbit adoption, some of the smaller breeds are frequently called mini Rex, mini Lop. They tend to be the smaller breeds. Some of the smaller breeds are more high strung. I would say if you're looking to adopt a rabbit that is being fostered by somebody in the House Rabbit Society might be your first place to look, or the Dane place. I've forgotten where you're calling from, but
Madison.
Madison. So a local humane society, Dane County Humane Society, frequently has quite a few rabbits that are, most of which are already we would call them adults, anything a year of age or older. So House Rabbit Society, they foster rabbits. The people there know rabbits really well. The Dane County Humane Society, if you choose to go to a breeder or a pet store, that's another possibility as well. And you're looking for a lot of the mini breeds, anything called a mini Rex, a mini Lop, for the smaller breeds. I believe you asked about vaccination and
yes.
litter. Vaccination, there are no, I'm going to say this and then so there are no vaccines that are routine. We're getting a lot of questions currently about rabbit hemorrhagic disease virus, which is an exotic virus and is in the western United States predominantly. It is has a very high mortality rate in pet rabbits, and it's killing a lot of wild rabbits. And there is an unlicensed vaccine in the United States that is being used in pet rabbits on the West Coast. It hasn't hit Wisconsin yet. It's not a worry, but I'm getting questions about it. That may be a vaccine of the future once if the virus hits Wisconsin. And we're able to get approval from the federal government to use that vaccine. But I didn't want to go off on a tangent, but routine vaccinations are not something that you have to worry about in rabbits. And then litter, I prefer a lot of the paper litter products. Things like Yesterday's News, that's crumpled newspaper, sort of condensed newspaper, because if rabbits eat paper products, they do expand in the stomach a little bit, but they tend to be passed relatively easily compared to some of the clumping litter products if they ingest it. So I like a lot of the condensed paper products that are available, because they're non-toxic if they eat it, and if they eat it, they tend not to have any sort of digestive issues.
Oh. Lydia, does that help out? Did we get all your questions?
Yes, but one question I have is, how can you tell if a rabbit is healthy just by looking at it? I mean, are there certain, should it look a certain way, the eyes, the coat, the way it behaves?
Yes. Any rabbit should be very bright, alert, responsive to you. They should not look dull. You kind of can see sick rabbits tend to be dull. If they have any sort of upper respiratory tract disease, sometimes you'll see a little crustiness under their nose or a crusty material near their front legs because they wipe their nose. They're like little kids. They wipe their nose with their front legs. And so sometimes their nose looks clean, but they have a little crusty mucus on their front legs. So look for that. Look for, you know, obviously Lop rabbits have ears that hang, but most of the breeds that have ears that stand straight up should be looking kind of standing straight up, again, very alert. They're prey species, so they're always kind of alert and watching the environment. No droopy eyes. Their hair coat, particularly in the rear end part, some obese rabbits will not take care of themselves, will not clean themselves on their rear end very well. So look for fecal matting or urine staining on their rear end if you pick them up. If you're not used to looking at sort of healthy rabbits versus sick rabbits, some of this may be more difficult when I say they should be bright and alert and responsive. But I think you'll kind of have a sense that if you go to a humane society or you go to the House Rabbit Society, or a pet store, that the rabbits should look bright and respond to you. If you pick them up, they should be very responsive. Maybe they want to get away from you if they're young and feisty, but...
there you go, Lydia. Thank you so much. Great questions. Our guest today, Dr. Kurt Sladke, clinical professor of zoological medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. You can join in at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talking about rabbits and other exotic pets here on the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller, taking a look at pet care and exotic animals in particular with our guest, Dr. Kurt Sladke, a clinical professor of zoological medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. Questions for him? Give a call, 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Nancy from Waukesha says they have had pet rabbits get along really well with their cats. What animals do pet rabbits interact with best? She also wanted to know how to find a vet with rabbit care experience.
Yeah, so rabbits can get along with, it's always surprising. You think a cat and a rabbit aren't going to get along. It's a predator and a prey species. But depending on the personality, the aggressiveness of your cat or dog, they can get along just fine with cats and dogs. But you need to be very careful introducing a new rabbit to a cat. For example, sometimes animals that are raised around, like if you have a rabbit in the house and you bring a young cat in or a young dog in, sometimes if they're raised around an adult rabbit, they grow up with that animal and think it's just part of the family. So you just need to be very careful. Rabbits like other rabbits, but not always. Rabbits aren't always compatible. One of the things we see, because we work with the House Rabbit Society a bit, we see the House Rabbit Society will let you take a rabbit home and introduce it, maybe through some sort of a barrier to your other rabbit to see how they interact with each other through like a caging, through a mesh where they can see and smell each other, but they can't get at each other because rabbits will fight. We do see some rabbits who just don't get along and can cause some pretty significant injuries. So rabbits do like other rabbits, but they can also get along with a variety of other pets in the house, dogs and cats. You just need to be really careful how you introduce rabbits to a pet rabbit to your, if you have a dog or a cat already in the house.
Yeah, makes sense.
Or vice versa.
Yeah. Ross in Middleton, your turn. Hi, Ross.
Hi, thanks for the show. The question I have is a bit more general. When you're looking at an older animal and you might think it's getting near its lifespan, end of its lifespan, how do we know, what are the things that we can look at when we, if the animal is comfortable? So if they start to get ill, if they start to get kind of aged sort of things, and how do I know if it's comfortable or just doing okay?
That is a really great question. I get that a lot, especially at end of life decisions when people need to make that decision about euthanizing an animal. And for us, it's the hardest part of my job, not only trying to discuss that issue, but actually having to euthanize animals is really the toughest part of, I think, any vet's job. In some ways, we typically tell people, I think you'll know, which is very vague, but and depends on how stoic your pet is. So some dogs in severe arthritic pain or other cancer pain may just keep going. You know, they eat, they still interact, and you feel like, okay, I know that my animal is not normal, and maybe in some discomfort, but they still seem to be eating. They still seem to be reacting to me, wagging their tail, whatever species it is. In general, we always say, I think you'll know, because usually animals, maybe we allow it to go too long sometimes because we don't want to give up. But animals that kind of have reached that they can't compensate anymore. They are decompensating. They have fought and fought and fought and now have kind of hit the wall and are decompensating. Usually will stop eating or decrease their food intake. Maybe they're not interested in going outside and urinating, defecating as frequently. And maybe they have more accidents in the house because they you know, it's more painful for them to go out. And some animals get to the point where they just look like they're giving up. They kind of look you in the eye, and you can almost, it's almost like they're looking through you. They're just not interacting with you like they once did. And I think the hardest part is at what point do I say, okay, it's time. I think my animal's in pain. I think there's a lot of discomfort. I think my animal's miserable. Those are, and we all want them to be, we all want them to kind of hang on. I think we're all so attached to our animals. We all want them to hang on. But I think you get to the point where they just don't seem happy anymore. That, you know, life is pretty simple. If you're a dog, you go outside, you go to the bathroom, you eat, you wag your tail, you get pets, you beg for chips at the table when people are eating. All of those things start fading as an animal gets older and maybe experiencing more and more pain.
Yeah, that's a very, very, very tough thing. And I would think that with other exotic animals, it might be really difficult, or maybe not. Lizards or, you know, reptiles, things of that nature, just to know that they're not well.
It is really difficult. And I study... One of the things I study is how to manage pain in exotic animals. So in small mammals and reptiles and even fish and birds, it's very difficult to see behavioral changes in some of these animals that would indicate the equivalent of pain. So like you mentioned, a snake or a lizard, it's sometimes very difficult. They may stop eating regularly, but they don't vocalize when they're in pain. Some dogs will vocalize when they're in pain. Some cats will vocalize when they're in pain. But some of the exotic animals, it's very difficult to tell how to recognize painful behavior in these animals. It's really quite a challenge. And especially if you look at predators and prey species like rabbits and birds hide their illness so well until they can't. So they cover it up. They don't show an owner that they're sick until they decompensate. And then when they show that they're sick, they're usually very sick. They're usually, they've hid it long enough from you. Now they can't compensate anymore. And as an owner, once you see that, especially in a bird, you need to really react to it much more rapidly. In these prey species that like to hide their pain.
Yeah. Steve in Madison, your turn. Hi, Steve.
Yeah, hi. I'm just wondering about wild rabbits. We got a, just live in a city a lot here in our backyard. We've got a little guy that's just been running around for weeks, and he hasn't grown. He seems to be all by himself. There is adult rabbits we've seen in, you know, the early part of the season and stuff. And I'm just wondering, is there such a thing as runts in this area, or am I just looking at more than just one bunny?
So this is certainly a popular time to see young rabbits outside. Yeah. Rabbits, once they leave the nest, mom doesn't take care of them anymore. They're kind of on their own. So you may see little rabbits running around because they've just left the nest. In terms of a rabbit that doesn't seem to be growing, it's possible you're seeing multiple rabbits, certainly. A rabbit that's not growing, it could have some sort of developmental disability, or perhaps it's not growing because it's not feeding properly, or it's loaded with parasites. Sometimes external parasites like fleas and mites can cause severe illness in some of these young rabbits, and because they're parasites that feed on blood. When they're loaded with fleas and mites, they actually can become anemic and become emaciated and not feeding. So it's possible. Anything's possible. It's possible you're seeing multiple rabbits, or you actually see an animal that may have some other problem. you know, it's also possible to see a runt rabbit, but usually it's some other issue that's causing the lack of growth.
Yeah, there you go, Steve. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Dr. Kurt Sladke, our guest today, clinical professor of zoological medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We spent a lot of time talking about rabbits, and certainly we continue to do that, but we can also talk about other exotic animals as well. I've got some questions for him along those lines, and maybe you do too. If you do, you can call in at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. We are going to take a look at the news and find out what else is in store for us here on the Ideas Network, and then we'll be back with our guest, Dr. Kurt Sladke. He'll be with us right up till 12:30. I'm Larry Mueller, and you, my friends, are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here. Today we're talking all about exotic animals and what pet owners should know when choosing and caring for an exotic pet. Our guest, Dr. Kurt Sladke, clinical professor of zoological medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. So, what exotic animal pet care questions do you have? Give a call. Number's 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. And we have some callers online, so let's go to the phones. Michael in Milwaukee will give you a chance. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call. This is a great show. I had two questions. I know you guys are trying to get at the topic of rabbits. But one of the things I've seen, I actually saw people feeding rabbits cookies. And I once saw a rabbit take the cookie rather than, like, a piece of vegetable. And I'm wondering if rabbits have a sweet tooth. And the other question is about, like, lizards, bearded dragons. Why is it that they are so, I guess, feisty when they're younger, but then they kind of taper off and get sedentary when they're older?
Oh, okay.
Those are great questions. Thanks for those. So the rabbit, rabbits having a sweet tooth, they actually do have a bit of a sweet tooth. If you offer a cookie to a rabbit, generally they will take it. They like it. It's not good for them, but they're kind of like, I don't want to equate it to a kid with a bowl of broccoli and a bowl of Snickers bars in front of them, but it's kind of similar that there are some animals are attracted to those foods that probably aren't very healthy for them. So, if you offer a rabbit a cookie, they probably will take it or take a bite out of it. But it's sugar is not a good thing for rabbits to ingest. So we completely discourage those sort of sweet things. Bearded dragons. Generally, and this is true of most reptiles, when they're young, they tend to be more flighty, and the more you handle them, the more you spend time with them, the more they will adapt to your presence. They will absolutely respond to you as an individual, we see animals that are, especially reptiles, let's use bearded dragons that are maintained in an aquarium and never handled will kind of retain that feistiness, that more don't touch me, I don't want to be handled. If you grab them, they'll fight to get away, versus an animal that's been handled from a very young age and is used to you, they will tend to be much more passive, interactive, and that's true across many, many reptile species.
There we go, Michael. Thank you so much for that question. Let's turn to Dawn next from La Crosse. Hi, Dawn.
Hello, gentlemen. Interesting show. I have a question. I have about a three-year-old chinchilla that I rescued about a year ago, and I give him his regular food and his Timothy hay every day, but I'd like to give him some sort of treats, too, and I know they can't have too much sugar. He gets about two raisins a week, and I give him maybe three or four Cheerios every day, like those. But is there anything else that I can kind of treat him with?
So have you tried any other vegetables as treats? Like any,
no, I haven't.
Any dark leafy greens, or, you know, like cilantro, or even kale. I'd stay away from spinach, but cilantro, parsley, Italian parsley, curly parsley. Those tend to be, it depends on sort of his background. So you've only had him a year, you said, right? And he's three?
Right.
Did I get that right? Yeah. So it depends a bit on his background and what he's been exposed to. There are a lot of other treats. You know, we sometimes, for the chinchillas that stay with us, if they're relatively healthy, we sometimes give them a little craisin, like a cranberry raisin, or there are these little freeze-dried, these freeze-dried treats for chinchillas, little freeze-dried vegetable and fruit treats for chinchillas. But again, the fruits tend to be sugary. So if you can get your chinchilla, if your chinchilla believes that or thinks that a treat like cilantro is a good treat, I would use sort of those dark leafy green vegetables. Not too many, because a lot of them have too much calcium, high calcium, and too many in a given day may be more problematic. A couple of craisins or a couple of these freeze-dried vegetable treats that they sell for small mammals are not terrible, but I guess I'm promoting fresh vegetable matter rather than some of these over-the-counter pet treats as a better option.
There you go, Dawn. Thank you. Christina in Genworth, your turn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi there. I'm considering getting a canary, but I'm hedging because I often travel to see family in Missouri, Illinois, Oklahoma, various places like that. So can you talk about canaries and advise me about traveling with a canary, or should I just forego getting a canary and stick to feeding the wild canaries?
So that's a great question. So canaries can be really great pets. Usually, sometimes it's nice to have more than one, although if you get a male and a female, then they're going to start producing eggs. The female's going to start producing eggs. So some people, that's the reason why some people will maintain a canary, just an individual canary. People do get their animals used to traveling. It sounds like you drive mostly. You drive on your own. So some people do travel, have their birds travel with them regularly. You know, the things you have to think of are actually some birds. Some birds actually do have get motion sick. But generally canaries are not one of those species you typically think of when you travel. You need to think of overheated cars and all of those same issues that you would with any other pet that you're traveling with. And canaries aren't necessarily going to make as much noise as, say, a macaw parrot or something that screams if you're traveling. So you can get your bird used to that. You just have to be very careful of where, you know, you're traveling, how hot the car gets, transferring from a hot car to an air-conditioned room or something like that can sometimes set off some respiratory diseases in birds. So, and then if you end up not traveling with your canary and you get a canary, do you have somebody who can check in and make sure, kind of check in every day and make sure the canary's okay? That's usually the best bet. If you get a pet bird, is to have somebody either check in every day in on your house, or take your bird to a pet sitter where you trust that there aren't a lot of infectious diseases being transmitted in the environment. So if you decide, that was a long drawn out way of saying, if you get a canary, they can be very, they can be fun pets. And then you just need to decide if you want to adapt your canary to travel, or if you want to bring somebody into your house to care for your canary while you're traveling.
Yeah, good points. Thank you, Christina. Becky in Marquesan, it's your turn. Hi, Becky.
Hi. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you know about some of the laws governing some of these exotic pets, if there's state or local municipality laws that you run into with, you know, anything from spiders and snakes to monkeys and other exotic pets. And I'll take my answer offline, if that's okay.
All right. Thank
you. Thanks for the question. Yeah, there are state laws, and there are frequently municipal laws for keeping exotic pets. Some states have very strict and are getting more and more strict with maintaining some species. For example, pet primates are frequently banned in a lot of states or municipalities. In the state of Wisconsin, maintaining maintaining pets that are natural to the state, for example, raccoons, skunks, some of the wild bird species, it's illegal to maintain those pets without a DNR permit. In the state of Wisconsin, you can still, in some municipalities, you can still maintain sort of these small roadside zoos that have some big cats like lions and tigers. But it's very, each municipality can be very strict about owning large snakes, for example, or venomous snakes. Most places don't want you to own venomous snakes. Most states will ban that, or most municipalities. Primates are another biggie. Like I said, pet primates, another group that a lot of municipalities ban or forbid.
You know, I was thinking about the Netflix show Tiger King. That was really popular a few months back, and in some ways I think it brought attention to the big cat trade. How common is it to own big cats like tigers and lions?
I would say back in the late 90s, early 2000s, in the state of Wisconsin, it was surprisingly common that people would own a lion or tiger or two and then call themselves a roadside zoo and charge people to come and look at their animal. And there weren't a lot of rules back in the 90s where you had to have a USDA licensed facility, much like a real zoo would have to have. Nowadays, it's much less common. You have to have generally, if you have big cats in the state of Wisconsin, for example, you need to have a USDA license to be called at least a roadside zoo. And then obviously the bigger zoos like Milwaukee or Henry Vilas in Madison are accredited by the American Zoo Association as well. Hmm. So 20 years ago, it was not uncommon for us to actually have a pet tiger arrive at the vet school for an emergency.
Oh boy. That would be an emergency for the vet, too. Oh, man. Well, this whole business about trafficking and abandonment and population management for a lot of these pets is, a lot of these animals is an issue, is it not?
Boy, it's a major issue. Trafficking in wildlife internationally is a major issue for the, you know, especially for either the pet trade or trafficking in parts of animals for medicinal purposes, depending on the culture or the place you live in the world. It's a multi-billion dollar industry, and it's horrific. More locally, people frequently release their pets into the wild. We do know in the state of Florida, the Everglades is full of exotic pythons that tend to be Asian species that get very big and are eating all the native wildlife in the Everglades. You know, the estimate is still 30,000 exotic pet pythons that have been let loose in the Everglades and are thriving because they learn to eat. They learn to feed on other animals in the wild. But you know, the big issue several years ago was when monkeypox was found in prairie dogs in the state of Wisconsin. Back in the early 2003 or so, as I recall, and monkeypox is an exotic African virus that the prairie dogs picked up in a warehouse, in an exotic pet warehouse in Chicago from giant Gambian rats, which is a West African rat. The virus jumped to the prairie dogs. The prairie dogs went into the pet trade. And a little girl was diagnosed with monkeypox at the Marshfield Clinic, in fact. And they had to try to trace back, talk about contact tracing in coronavirus. They had to go and look at all of those prairie dogs that made it into the pet market, trace them back, find the people who owned those prairie dogs that had the monkeypox and try to find all of the animals and euthanize them. But the big scare back then was, what if people find out their prairie dog has monkeypox and releases it into the wild? And now you've got monkeypox in Wisconsin. So that was a major scare.
Well, fortunately, it was one of those scares that didn't come to fruition.
Right.
Boy.
Yeah, but it's scary. You know, this whole issue of wildlife trade and bushmeat hunting and eating wildlife, that's, you know, that's pretty much the thought for the current coronavirus. It's a bat associated virus, but it's not bats that transmit it to people. It's people eat bats and the virus mutates and becomes infective in people. So trafficking in wildlife, especially eating wildlife, is really a bad idea, but it's in cultures all over the world.
Let's take another call. Suzanne in Milwaukee, your turn now. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. I have an adopted red tabby cat that was huge, and he got into a fight with a rat, which he eventually killed. He's had to have a couple of medical procedures afterwards because of this. And now his behavior is so different. Is this a common thing?
Certainly, rats are super aggressive, and they can carry some diseases, certainly that people are susceptible to. There's a rat bite fever, that people can be susceptible to. There's a rat lungworm that some rats carry, that you've probably heard people can get from eating the intermediate host slugs. So your cat may have had such a traumatic experience that your cat the behavior has changed. This is one of the reasons in my field why we recommend, if you have a pet snake, don't feed a live rodent, because rodents that are cornered by a predator are going to fight. And a lot of times a snake that's fed a rat will lose to the rat. So your cat, it sounds like maybe not necessarily a disease issue as much as a traumatic issue that your rat mm-hmm. went through this trauma. It's kind of the same principle. If you've ever had a dog that's been bitten by another dog and their personality changes just from that traumatic incident. So without being too anthropomorphic, it's kind of like post-traumatic stress disorder. that your cat may take a while to come back, hopefully isn't introduced to any rats in the near future, which would exacerbate the problem. But it's almost like a post-traumatic stress disorder, that it may take your cat some time to kind of
get over it,
reacclimated to not having a rat around.
And thank you, Suzanne, for that call. You know, I'm kind of interested, Kurt, you do some pretty cool research. What are you focusing on these days?
So most of my clinical research is coming up with appropriate analgesic or drugs that alleviate pain in exotic species, because we know some about pain management in dogs and cats. There are a lot of drugs we have kind of in our armamentarium to treat pain, depending on the type of pain in dogs and cats or cows and horses. But we know so little of how to treat pain, like post-surgical pain in a rabbit or a bearded dragon. And so one of my big dilemmas that we had mentioned earlier is, how do you measure pain first? In order to treat pain, you have to be able to measure it in an animal. So what does pain look like in a rabbit? What does pain look like in a snake? What does pain look like in a hedgehog? And then what drugs might be most effective? What drugs that we have available might be most effective in treating that pain? And then if we can find an effective drug, what is the proper dosing regimen or dosage of the drug? If morphine works well in a bearded dragon, how do I know that it works well? And then what is a dose? Do I just extrapolate a dog dose? Well, that doesn't always work very well. And so a lot of my clinical research is sort of dedicated to how we can manage pain, even in fish species, because I do, my residents and I do a lot of work at zoos. We work at the Vilas Zoo. My residents work at the Milwaukee Zoo. We have a lot of different species that we have to treat and manage, pain, arthritic conditions, cancer pain, post-surgical pain. And so that's sort of I've kind of dedicated my career to that, to trying to make sure that we understand as much as we can about, if I have to do surgery on a fish, is that fish in pain, and how do I manage pain in a fish?
Well, this has been fascinating, Kurt. I want to thank you so much. I hope you'll be with us again. I really appreciate you being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Larry. Great questions today, everybody. Thanks for having me.
Dr. Kurt Sladke, clinical professor of zoological medicine at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. We'll get him back. It was a really fascinating show today. Tomorrow we'll look at the Niagara Escarpment on the show. In the meantime, thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots more in store on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.